Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast that delves into the most intriguing talking points across football today. I'm your host, Rob Fletcher, and today we're tackling a topic that raises fundamental questions not just about modern football, but modern life too. How is social media changing the relationship between players, clubs, and the fans? Times have changed dramatically in the last 20 years, and the technological advances have been huge. These have led to a boom in social media outlets and the increasing access fans have to their favourites that has never been seen before. But what are the positives and negatives about this? Alongside me today, delving into the role of social media players in football and making his first appearance on The Game, is Chris Lepkowski. Welcome to The Game, Chris.
Hello, I didn't realise this was my first appearance. Wow, I'm glad to be on. Honoured to be on, in fact. So, asking me.
Yeah, and I think these sort of pods that we're doing about modern football, just to kind of discuss some of these issues, I think is really important. And this one, I know for you personally, Chris Cotter, the sort of your background and what you do is really kind of intertwined with this one. And it's very different to maybe like last week's episode talking about formations and tactics, and the week before talking about formations of the Champions League or changes in World Cup formats. This is a very different one. But also, sort of 20 years ago, we were in a very different place, weren't we? I suppose, what was the key way for football clubs and players to get their messages out there or to be known?
I mean, it was a very different landscape 20 years ago. Probably take it back 25 years ago. 20 years ago, we were starting to get message boards, starting to get internet was growing, and we'd yet to see the start of Facebook. Instagram hadn't yet started, and of course the big one in my view, Twitter, hadn't yet come along, and the relationship was very different then. In terms of supporters and footballers, that the middleman in that was the media. The press would interview players, and the journalists would file copy that would go into a newspaper, onto a website, which was a new thing back then. Or if it was an interview on TV or radio, it would be heard or watched. So supporters had a relationship very much at arm's length. And to meet your player, to meet your favourite player, you had a choice. You could go to the match and wait for them after the game, or you could maybe hope that the club would have an open day or a Christmas party with the players, and you could maybe, or an end of season dinner, and you could maybe meet them there. So other than that, the only way supporters could meet players was to bump into them, which in the case of Birmingham was maybe to bump into them in Selfridges or in a nightclub and a bar. And the great thing was, from a footballer's point of view there, they could be as drunk and as raucous as they wanted to, and nobody would know anything about it, because if we had phones, then they would be very primitive phones that didn't have the technology to take videos or to take photos. So it was a very peculiar, what feels like a peculiar landscape now. I mean, from a media point of view, I was a working journalist then. My relationship was very much built on trust with players. So I had their numbers or generally home numbers and mobiles, because back then, you know, everyone had a home number before they had a mobile number. And if you wanted to interview them, you would call them. Around the start of the 2000s, end of the 90s, clubs started to get wise to the growth of Sky, the demands of Sky Sports, the demands of other channels, the demands of rights holders who were pumping money into Premier League football. And they realised that they needed bespoke people to sit there, taking these requests, facilitating interviews, and even babysitting players and managers through their interviews and press conferences to make sure that they didn't say something that would upset the directors or the club in general, or bring it into any kind of disrepute. And that's when things started to change. And certainly in the first two or three years of my job, working as a journalist, I worked in for 4-4-2-4-1, having worked in motor racing, and it was very relaxed. You'd phone players up, they'd answer, you'd hope they'd answer, you'd have a conversation. And then as press officers started to emerge, more and more restrictions started to be put in. And that's when the relationship, along with the arrival of social media, that's when the relationship really began to shift.
It's interesting, isn't it? I remember as a kid and into my teens and starting at university, where it was very much the access you had to players was what you read in the programme. So when you went to the game on a Saturday, there would be a, you know, manager interview around, you know, last week the refereeing decision was terrible, or we're hopefully going to win this week, or we're looking at signing two players. And then there was maybe one or two player interviews, and a lot of your opposition sort of information and detail came on the morning of the game, didn't it? You know, you bought your programme from the cellar on the way in, you sat and watched the warm-up and read about, you know, who all their players were. You knew who they were, but you didn't know every single player. You didn't have that wider access to them. And I very much grew up in the 90s watching Gazzetta Football Italia. So I was being fed like weekly information about Serie A, but not in the week. In the week, you would talk about with your friends, and you might pretend to be George Weah on the playground or Baggio or someone like that. But actually, you weren't being fed this diet of information that we get these days. And, you know, I grew up on watching things like Transworld Sport on a Saturday morning, or Football Focus to get your information, you know, match, shoot, like you say, 4-4-2. And all of that information was coming from an approved, shall we say, media outlet that's had to go through editors, and it's been passed through other people. It was filtered, wasn't it? It was kind of, it had been set up. And the ones I remember, and from writing my books, I've loved these ones. You remember the pieces in Shoot and Match where they go to a player's house?
Yeah.
And it'd be in the living room set with their thumbs up with their big TV and that kind of thing. It was almost like all set up, wasn't it? It was so different to what it is now.
It was, and the media landscape also changed. I mean, I remember in the, to give you some context, in the 1980s when I started to read a lot of football publications and started to read newspapers and things like CFAX and Oracle, or Teletext as it became, you have to remember that it wasn't particularly socially acceptable to be a football fan. You know, nobody really shouted about it because so many things had happened in the 80s, and hooliganism was at the core of it in many respects, and it wasn't socially acceptable to be telling people that you liked football. So it was a strange relationship, and you'd read interviews in magazines, and I remember buying Shoot, Match, and then when Saturday Comes drifted into my library, and in by the 90s it would be 4-4-2, which just celebrated its 30th anniversary, and then there would be maybe Total Football and World Soccer, and you'd read these publications with an element of awe, in a way that firstly that you were able to read and consume these fantastic interviews with people that you would never see or never know. The World Cup in the going back probably up to 1990, I'd say, was this event where you'd learn about new players. You'd know about England and Scotland and Northern Ireland. You might know a little bit of the European players if there were continental club games. But then the South Americans would turn up, and if they didn't play in Europe, you wouldn't have a clue who they were. You know, Claudio Caniggia, who is this guy? And all of a sudden, you've got new heroes. And of course, African teams started to emerge more and more. They had more places to more World Cup places given to them. So all of a sudden, the World Cup became this big festival of football where you came away with more knowledge than you went into it. Now, social media, digital media has changed that. I don't think anyone now goes into a major tournament not really shocked by the emergence of a player, because we will know about that player in the build-up because of what he does at his club, because of what he's done in other internationals. And now, as great as that is, that kind of education, if you like, into other teams, other players, it's removed a little bit of that magic that maybe you had 30, 40 years ago when players were relatively unknown to you going into major tournaments.
Yeah, it was always the excitement, wasn't it, of waiting for the souvenir special in the newspaper to come out like 2 weeks before the World Cup with the wall chart, the fixtures and where everyone was, and it would list all the squads. You'd get the sticker book a month before or 6 weeks before trying to collect everyone. So you actually knew what these players looked like. Because if you got the supplement from the Daily Mirror or whatever it was, often they wouldn't have images of the players. It would just be a little bio, wouldn't it, of, you know, what team they play for, what position they play, maybe how many caps they've got. And that was kind of it. And I think my, you know, USA 94 was the first one for me, World Cup. And I remember having those and getting the sticker album that I've still got now, actually. And that's how you got your information. You pulled all the information in. And I also think about, remember Shoot and Match used to do those end of year specials. So it'd be like an annual that would recap all the stories from the year. So they're almost functioning as like a mini Wikipedia page of the season or that calendar year. And you could track back the transfers and all those moments. But as you say, you know, television kicks in and globalization kicks in and the money starts flowing to football. In those early 2000s, I remember being at university when Facebook arrived and you had to have a university email account to actually get on Facebook at the time initially, because obviously it started in Harvard or whatever. And then this is where it starts to boom. So in terms of those early days, I suppose, you mentioned a little bit about message boards and how that started to boom and rumours start being shared, don't they, about transfers and injuries and what's happening with this player and what's happening with this manager. In those early days of social media, it almost did very much function like a window into a player's mind. I mean, sometimes they get retweeted, don't they, and reposted or reshared. There's the famous one of Wayne Rooney, isn't there, with Rio Ferdinand, you know, I'll come and pick you up at 8:30 at your house, Rio, or whatever it was. It was very much just players, naively maybe, literally just sharing their thoughts and ideas, wasn't it?
It was, and for a few months, a couple of years, we had this unusual situation where clubs were kind of lagging behind a little bit with their, well, not all clubs, but some clubs were lagging behind with their social media etiquette and how players should present themselves on social media. So you had this bizarre period where you would have Wayne Rooney tweeting Rio Ferdinand to say pick him up, or you'd have, I don't know, I remember famously the Everton admin by accident forgetting to switch accounts and saying they were going shopping one Saturday when there was no match on, and you had footballers maybe just making general observations that all of a sudden are like conversational, and you see people respond to them, and maybe it'll be somebody giving them abuse or praising them, and there'll be a response. And that's where that relationship starts to change, because all of a sudden that centre forward who you adore or that goalkeeper who's been throwing them in are people that you can not only see on a Saturday and then watch on Match of the Day and maybe listen to their interviews afterwards, but you can now engage with them. You can interact with them. You can tell them how brilliant, how much you love them, but you can also tell them how bad they are. You can abuse them, you can harass them, you can say they're the worst goalkeeper the club's ever had, etc. And all of a sudden, everything feels like a Wild West. You know, you daren't be a footballer and have a bad game because you know what's coming. Now, going back into the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, a footballer would know if he played badly because the manager would tell him. He might hear heckles from the stands. And then maybe on the Sunday or Monday, buy a newspaper and see that he got 4 or 5 out of 10. And he'd be chasing that reporter up and he'd give him the evils the next time he saw him at the match. And that happened a few times. But that was it. That was the relationship that the footballer had outside the bubble. And social media removes that bubble. It completely transforms it into this two-way relationship that they probably don't want, but they have to accept is part of their life now.
Yeah, I remember I started on Twitter in about 2008, I think, or 2009. So I'd set up an account and you could literally chat to anyone and people would reply and you'd have quite good conversation, as long as you know, reasonably sensible and you weren't being offensive. You could have good conversation with a whole wide range of people, whether it was authors, journalists. They'd always reply because it wasn't as big as it got. Even, you know, some ex-players or whatever would get involved and you could compliment on them a goal or playing for your club or whatever. And it started, you mentioned a little bit before about how journalists would have all the information of the other players' phone numbers and addresses, and they gave them a ring if they needed some quotes or some copy for, you know, on a Friday afternoon because they were trying to frantically fill something before Saturday because something had changed or whatever. And it actually slowly started to strip away those layers that were previously stopping fans, like you say. The only way you could tell them is you could boo them on a weekend or you could cheer them on a weekend, or you could wait by the exit for the bus as they leave the ground with your autograph book or your shirt to sign or something like that. Actually, they were at the end of the phone while you were watching them on TV, you know, whether it was live or a match of the day or whatever, they were actually physically there. And I feel like that was such a big thing that quickly, obviously, clubs realised that the players were slowly becoming almost media commodities even more than they had been previously. So if we kind of skip on a decade, if you like, so kind of mid-2010s and onwards, we're starting to see a little bit more of a, shall we say, a sanitised version of these interactions, and everything slowly starts to become a little bit more managed, doesn't it? And so we've gone from this thing where we can see them in match and shoot and kind of match of the day, and we can get our signatures, and they're probably quite open at this time, you know, because the media commitments aren't huge. Then we have this burst of Twitter where people start being more open. But then it does start to change that relationship, doesn't it, with fans, where the players are a bit more managed, aren't they? And their tweets are a little bit more, thank you for the support today, everyone. We go again next week and make sure we'll get the win for the Reds or whoever it is. It really does move that. I'm not going to say it's a dishonesty because that's unfair, but it does sort of, it is that sanitized version we get now, isn't it, I suppose, or probably the last 7 or 8 years. So that fan-player relationship is different again, isn't it, in this sort of period.
Yeah, you get the infamous Vic Tranakshibi tweet where he literally copied and pasted what an agent had told him to write, and he tweet something like this. Yeah, and clubs wised up to it, because clubs, the thing with football clubs, they want to control everything. They see footballers as their commodity, their property, and they want to ensure that footballers stay on message. They don't want them going rogue. So those interactions on social media have become more sanitised. They have become almost more controlled. And I know clubs now, as part of media training, the media training they give to players, firstly, they'll remind players of all of their responsibilities, you know, how to conduct yourself, how would you deal with this scenario. But that is being filtered down into the academy level. So a lot of young players who are coming through, because, of course, with the added profile of football, a lot of media now and a lot of fans are going to watch youth games and the different level games, and players at that level are being told how to react, how to deal with any media requests or how to deal with media interviews. They are being told to be careful about what they post on social media, and we've seen it in the past where footballers have been tripped up about posts they made when they were children, you know, and it's become a very managed and sanitised relationship, really, whereby fans, I think the naive fans still think that the players are talking to them. And sometimes they are. And there are players who control their own social media and they're good at it and that they use it in a positive way. But there are players who seemingly do it just to, as part of a bigger brand of themselves, and they don't give as much care or engagement to it. And that's obvious as well. And it's really, I think the big losers in this, in many respects, have been the actual traditional media, who all of a sudden have been made to feel maybe not redundant, but certainly the power they had has completely been diluted. Because if we go back to the 90s, when you were young, and the 80s before that, and then probably extending into the 2000s, the guys who, and it would almost certainly be guys, not, it would be very few women, it would be a very white male environment, the press, the media, they would be very much talking at people in form of newspapers, radio. They were talking at people and they wouldn't know about the criticism they were getting. They wouldn't know that their comments were maybe being agreed with or not. And their interviews, they would regard themselves as friends of the clubs, friends of the players, friends of the managers, and now often they were. And the whole explosion of digital and social media and the demands of the media, I mean, without digressing too much, I know Manchester United get about 150 media requests a week. So inevitably, it'll be the rights holders who get those interviews rather than the traditional press of newspapers or the local radio station, for instance. So all of a sudden, the media are finding their power reduced on two sides. Firstly, from the club, because the club are trying to ring fence their content to themselves. They don't want media to necessarily have the best content. Why would they? And then on the other side of that relationship, you've got the fans. The fans now probably don't need the media as much because, firstly, they can read everything on the website, the club website, if they really want to, or they'll see the club tweeting about it, players tweeting something, even managers and owners tweeting something. And it's diminished that relationship, that power that the media, the press had for so many years.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Chris, do you think that's an English football thing, or do you see that kind of more across Europe as well in terms of like the management of the media? Because I know obviously the Premier League is not really the English Premier League anymore. It's the global Premier League, isn't it, that just happens to be played in England with our tradition and cultures. Is there still, because I know media obviously in Spain and Italy were really, really powerful in terms of kind of what narrative they were spinning. Do we find that this is more of an English thing, or is it just more of a worldwide thing these days?
I think it's, I mean, I'm not fully in au fait with the practices of all countries, but generally from speaking to journalists, I think it's affected them everywhere. If you look at it from an English perspective, for many years, we had the tabloid wars between the Sun and Mirror, and that led to almost arrogant reporting in many respects. The ability to get personal, or if that's an ability, or the want to be personal against individuals like England managers, Manchester United managers, Liverpool managers, players, and clubs couldn't do much about it, and fans consumed it or they didn't if they didn't want to. That doesn't happen now. And I think Gareth Southgate really epitomised this. I saw somebody recently saying that the press had made his life hell, and I'm thinking, they really didn't. They really, really didn't. The press were actually on his side, and it was social media supporters that were the real critic. And there are two reasons for that. Firstly, the media quite like Gareth Southgate, but also they no longer have that power to be that voice anymore. They no longer are that respected bastion that they used to be, where people would go and read the Sun or the Daily Mirror or the paper of their choice and lap everything up. People don't need to do that anymore. And circulation of newspapers have gone down, and that's no longer applicable.
Yeah, I think that point about Southgate is a really interesting one, that it's almost flipped it. Because I remember in the 90s as a ball fan, it was always the England manager who was getting slated for anything, even if they won or if they didn't win well enough. And I think you're right about fans being the ones who were pushing against Southgate a lot more, because maybe they had their own club biases that have probably only increased over time on social media, especially, you know, it's quite a tribalistic place, isn't it? You know, Cole Palmer should be playing instead of Phil Foden, even though Phil Foden's won however many league titles, a Champions League, has just been player of the year. We want our player to be in there. Therefore, the manager doesn't know what he's doing. It's amplified a lot more. And I don't know whether decisions get made now because of that, but there's potential that clubs are thinking, actually, we're getting a bit of a bad rap here. Our manager's under the cosh a little bit. We're getting this kind of feeling of people not being on board with us. Because at the end of the day, clubs now are almost like mini media conglomerates. They've got, you know, the men's team, the women's team, the academy teams. They all get pumped through social media with all the different tweets about the matches and the scores and the goals. And it's a very, very different landscape. Sometimes, I suppose, they've got no choice really to kind of bow down to what fans want, because at the end of the day, football has become so commercial that they're almost like going to watch a movie. You know, do I want to go to the match? Do I care about it? They've got to have so much build-up. Do you think that's, I mean, you mentioned before a little bit about how the media sort of changed and their role has changed. Do you think because clubs have become so big and so powerful that the media maybe have to sort of align themselves a little bit more with the clubs maybe than they would have in the past?
I think so. I mean, there's a few things around that. Firstly, social media has empowered a lot of fans to feel that they are more insightful of football. They are more literate when it comes to tactics and the machinations of clubs. I've always said to people that if you're given a choice of spending one day at your favourite football club, do not take it, because it will completely shatter all the myths, all the magic that you ever built up about it. But social media has given them a little bit of a shop window into what things are like. You can get behind the scenes coverage, for instance, and interviews with managers. And that has had a knock-on effect with the traditional media, because certainly going back, I mentioned the circulation wars between the Daily Mirror and the Sun. But also other journalists, you know, journalists used to be rivals a lot more than they are now. They used to, you know, it was the big thing to get an exclusive that nobody else had. That's increasingly difficult now, because clubs can control their content so much more. They can control what the journalists have. And I know of football clubs where journalists now are restricted to one or two questions each, which is just madness. I mean, that's control beyond anything. And rather than now the Sun or the Mirror or local media being rivals with each other, now they have to almost work together, because their big rival is the football club. It's that club who have got video channels. It's that football club who have got social media channels, who have got an all singing, all dancing website that isn't like the Reach PLC website that has pop-ups popping up, or isn't like The Athletic or The Telegraph where you have to pay a subscription to read it. So football clubs now are driving their own content, and now they can lord it over the independent press. Now that creates a problem, because you increasingly get supporters believing and lapping up everything they're told. Not everyone, but we're breeding a generation of people who will nod their head to everything their club tells them. And if they tell them it's raining today, rather than look out the window and see that it's nice and sunny, they will just believe what they're told. So I don't actually think it's been beneficial. And I think what the media perhaps should be doing more of is taking more of a independent stance. But you're absolutely right in that they are becoming more pally with clubs. I mean, I've seen some, to give you some context, when I covered a football club full time for a newspaper, I got on well with a press officer, but I was kept very much at arm's length, because that was rightly the relationship that it should have been from my end and from his end, because we are effectively working at cross purposes. Now, he could help me, I could occasionally help him as a journalist, but there had to be a distance. That distance is eroded now, and the two work more closely. And I mean, I see a lot of people get on the back of local media, and it's pretends to be local media especially, of all clubs, saying they need to hold the clubs more to account, and they won't do it because they'll have their access removed. Well, I'm of the view that clubs don't need, newspapers and traditional media don't need that access as much, because all the content is out there. All the press conferences are out there. Player interviews are out there. Actually, what they probably need to do more of is be more stronger independent voices and actually take the clubs to task, bring them and hold them to account a lot more. But it seems that there is an element now of some media wanting a much easier, calmer relationship with the patches, the clubs on the patch they cover or the clubs they cover. And it's not great, but it is understandable, because inevitably a guy working for a local newspaper or working covering the patch for a national newspaper or national media group just wants an easy life. It doesn't want to have that conflict with a club. That conflict with a club, inevitably the fans will always side with the club. That's how it goes, because how dare you support or how dare you speak out about my club? And it gets very tribal. And it's a really, social media has especially had a really big impact on that independent media, who all of a sudden now have to try and decide which sides to take when there is a conflict, or whether they're even going to dig into a conflict.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because the marketplace is so competitive because there are subscriptions that you need to pay for if you want to access everything now. You can't just go to the shop and buy The Athletic. You've got to have the yearly subscription. What offer you get it from? And it's kind of got to be, we're either all in harmony or we're all in conflict, because all it takes is one person to be the opposite and you lose out. So if The Athletic decide, right, not to say they are obviously, but they might say, right, we're going to be on the side of every club, blah, blah, blah. Right, all the clubs will just work with them, because if anyone else is in conflict, they'll just be cut out. Similarly, if they say, right, we want to be more independent, we want to have more sort of thought pieces or think pieces on matches and whatever, if one publication says, we're not going to do that, we're going to sort of get in bed with the clubs, if you like, it totally unravels the whole model. And one thing I suppose I want to bring up with social media is that kind of fan interaction that we've got now. So obviously, you know, 10 years ago, whatever it was, things like Arsenal TV came out and they were on social media and people took it as a bit of a joke and everyone laughed at them for being so annoyed and whatever. I always found it quite ironic that the people who were laughing at them were the people who were probably doing that in the pub after the game with their friends. It's just now a light has been shone on that kind of fandom. But now, obviously, most clubs have got their own podcasts. You know, I've done one myself for Middlesbrough, and I've done magazines and whatnot, and I'm still on one now. And we talk about our football club, and they didn't really exist outside of the fanzine that you bought outside the ground for a quid, only on the home game. So, you know, once a fortnight, once every 3 weeks. But actually now, even those organisations are almost run like commercial media outlets now. They've got some of the Manchester United ones, they've got like 1 million followers. 2 million followers. They run like big businesses almost, in the sense that they want access from the club, but they can't always get it. So they go to the extremes, don't they? Often with their viewpoints of, you know, he should never play for us again. We should never have signed him. We should sack everybody. And very much that pushes the content. And almost now, the fans, every match is the opportunity to create content. So it's either the manager's the best in the world, we're going to get in the Champions League, we're going to be in the top six, we're going to be in the top four, the top two, or we're going to never get relegated from the league. Or on the flip side, we want them sacked, we want them out, because it's almost those polarizing viewpoints that are actually now coming out of fans on social media and not from sort of the direct media outlets.
I alluded to it earlier. Supporters have never had greater access to produce content, but it doesn't mean that there isn't still a big streak of ignorance there in some respects, and a failure to understand how a lot of things work at football clubs. What you see now is that everyone who has a phone is a content provider. They can deliver content. It could be a short video. It could be a few hundred words about something they're passionate about. It could be a podcast. And you get a lot of uninformed views, not all the time, but a lot of the time, because it is impossible for fans to have that access into the clubs to see what goes on behind the scenes. You know, I see it all the time. Why isn't so-and-so, that left back from Italy, getting a chance? Why isn't he getting a chance? And you think, well, hang on a second. You only see him on a Saturday or see what goes on a Saturday. You don't see every day of the week what goes on in that week. You don't see the data. You don't see all the things that managers and coaches are privy to, and they put a lot of value in. And social media has allowed people to have a greater voice, but it's not always a voice that is informed. It's not always a voice that is based on anything other than opinion and subjective opinion. And that's always a danger, because people listen to it, people lap it up, but it's not always a reflection of what is actually happening. And that does make it difficult. That does muddy the waters, because we can all take a view on certain things. And let's say that the guys who are producing the podcast from the local newspaper, they will have a greater insight than a guy who sits in the stands on a Saturday, works doing something else during the week, and then produces a podcast full of anger, full of bile, with lots of opinion in there. But it's very much a one line and one window of opinion. There's no informed viewpoint there. It's a bit like shouting at people in the pub, you know. We can all do it, but it doesn't mean we're all right, and it doesn't mean that we're speaking with any great knowledge. That's not to say that applies to all, because there are some excellent independent podcaster, aren't even media necessarily, but who produce good content. I mean, there's a guy who supports Birmingham City, for instance, who he's not a journalist. He's not, I think he runs a podcast now, but he unraveled the whole financial and ownership issue at the club a few years ago. Now, none of the independent media did that because they didn't have the resources, the time to do that. It needed a fan to do that. Now, that's a positive. That's a reflection of how social media has enabled certain people to empower themselves and actually do some good and be a strong independent voice. But too many, too often, that one positive will get lost among the sea of rabble-rousing, among the sea of, you know, the manager must go if he loses two games on the bounce, or he's the best manager we've ever had, he's the GOAT if he scores two goals in a game, or whatever. And, you know, we've lost that whole rationale of being fair, trying to be objective, has been blurred by this wave of subjectivity and fandom and tribalism. And that's a real issue, I think, that social media has created. It's not the worst problem that social media has created because it's only football. But from a football perspective, it can be damaging because so much truth can so many non-truths can get reported as being truthful, and that's not the case always.
It does bleed into other things, doesn't it? You know, in the past, if it was, I remember going on the Middlesbrough message boards in the early 2000s or whatever, it was just Middlesbrough fans. So it was kind of, you had that own your own little echo chamber, because you all support the same team, you all kind of ended up thinking similar things. Whereas now, if you put a piece of content out there on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook or whatever, you could have a Birmingham City fan, a West Brom fan, a Sunderland fan, a Liverpool fan, an Everton fan, now arguing with your opinions on your club because it might infringe on their club or their opinions of you. And I think those interactions very rarely are positive. I mean, I've had some great interactions with fans of other clubs, and I've had some really terrible ones where I've not really said anything too controversial. I might just disagree with them. But actually, I might say, I disagree with you. I had them with some Chelsea fans actually about Maresca. And I thought he wasn't the right man for their club, and they needed someone more experienced and whatnot. And he's doing well so far, and I'm glad he's doing well because that means Chelsea fans are happy. But I'm not going to lose any sleep if he isn't. That was just my opinion at the time based on what I'd seen with Leicester City and the Championship, and the fans didn't like the football a lot of the time, etc., etc. It doesn't make me an idiot. It doesn't make me stupid because I disagree with someone. It's actually just having a different viewpoint. And I think what we're losing a little bit, like you say, is that balance. And maybe sort of the written press, obviously part of their training and part of their growing up through, coming up through the ranks and writing, is actually having that balance, that fairness, that, you know, putting your eye on what you can see and reporting that as you see it, not reporting it as you think the fans might want to see it, which very much, I think, a lot of fan-based media is, well, if I make a comment about Erik ten Hag, then I'll get a million clicks because everyone else hates him like me too. When actually, he's won a couple of trophies. He's bought some players who cost a lot of money. But when haven't the clubs bought players that cost a lot of money? Everybody signed bad players. My club have done it. Your club have done it. Everybody does it. It's just the fact that you're in the limelight, the media spotlight, that it feels worse and they've had big successes and whatnot. It doesn't mean he's the worst man in the world. It just means that he can't get the team in the top four.
It's quite interesting that I see a lot of these accounts spring up where they report transfer news that's already out there, and they'll then put on some kind of emoji to symbolise how reliable that information is. They'll have taken it from a journalist, a proper journalist who's been trained and works for a newspaper or publication or media organisation they don't like, and they'll immediately rule it out as being unreliable. And I'm kind of thinking, it's a bit like me drawing up a list of dentists and saying, well, which one would I go to get my teeth drilled or my mouth seen to, and judging each one with nothing more than perception and this Dunning-Kruger notion that I know everything about those dentists. You know, it's the same with so many people now who use social media to prejudge proper bespoke media organisations and the work they produce, as if a journalist would deliberately put some misleading transfer news on there just to annoy them. And I've noticed the shift in young journalists coming through. I'm, of course, director in sports journalism, and I recall about 5 years ago asking all the journalists, the students on their first day, who do you aspire to be? You know, why are you on this course? And you get sort of Henry Winter, you get maybe somebody from Sky, somebody from BBC Five Live, Talk Sports, et cetera, great. Now, increasingly, you get people like, I want to be like Fabrizio Romano, because these students, these youngsters, 18-year-olds, are seeing this brand, this human brand who has 12, 30 million followers, who are simply regurgitating and posting transfer news. And it's creating a real subculture, and not always a good one, but an interesting one that we have to work through, especially when we train young journalists, because you have to remove them from the social media noise and sometimes remind them that actually, you know what, before you become a journalist, and this is what a lot of people don't understand, we're going to train you for 3 years. We're going to teach you about law so you don't defame people, so you don't libel people. We're going to treat you about balance and fairness and ethics in journalism and reporting. And we're going to teach you some of the tricks that John 124 from Watford doesn't know when he posts his podcast about, that's really angry about the club he supports and things like that. Because like I say, social media has been a blessing and a curse for supporters, but also in my game, which is sports media.
What do you think then, Chris? So, I mean, social media is not going anywhere. We know that. It may be that platforms are diluted. The platform formerly known as Twitter is a very different place to what it used to be. Facebook's changed an awful lot. A lot of journalism, in inverted commas, comes through sort of newspapers using Instagram or TV channels using Instagram and TikTok sort of after the game, where their pundits will record a short little 30-second piece, which I remember getting in the pink sports papers at 6 o'clock from the local news agent after on the way back, which I never knew how they got those in the shops by that time, by the way, because that is a feat that'll never be matched by any online media platform, by the way, that you could get home from the match at 5, then walk down to the corner shop and get the pink Evening Sports Gazette and read about the game. But anyway, that was crazy. What's the future? What does it look like for journalists? If you, those people who are starting your course who are 18, 19, they want to make a really good fist of being a journalist and all those qualities that you've mentioned. Can that exist anymore now the sort of genie is out of the bottle? Or, you know, things like Substack are coming back again, which is pretty much just WordPress and blogging from 10, 15 years ago. Is there going to be a shift? Are we going to see more of your journalists that you train maybe trying to work for clubs directly now more than for print media or print organisations? What's the future in this?
Well, you actually preempted what I was going to say in many respects, because you're right that increasingly the journalists that come through my course might end up working for clubs, organisations within a sport. So it could be an F1 team, it could be a football club, maybe cricket club, or a governing body of some sort in a media department. So being that admin, if you like, or being that person who does the videos or commentates on the match day or does the interviews with a manager after a game. Independent media, that, you know, it's no secret that organisations are struggling. They're struggling to stay active. They're struggling to keep people in work. So there are fewer opportunities there, but there are still opportunities. And I think increasingly, journalists on my course have to be agile, want to be agile, so be able to write, be able to speak, be able to be visually appropriate in delivering news. And they have to have an entrepreneurial mind as well, because like you say, with Substack and other mechanics that enable them to earn money, they are going to have to be brands, maybe, you know. And if you look at certainly when The Athletic started with their recruitment, they were employing a lot of journalists who were brands, social media brands, who had massive followings. And I think there is so much value placed, so much importance placed in social media followings, especially in that industry, that young journalists have to embrace that. And they might hate it, and they will hate it, and they'll have a very difficult relationship with social media at times, but it's going to be so important. And I think whilst you're right that Twitter has taken a very dark swing to the right in the way its algorithms work and what we see, it is still the go-to social media. And until Blue Sky or until Threads become more popular, maybe grow organically or in other ways, or something else emerges that we don't yet know about, then X, as it's called now, or used to be called Twitter, will remain quite important. But, you know, I am seeing a shift. I am seeing more people head towards Blue Sky and Threads and even Instagram using their channels there. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic. But like we've said throughout this podcast, while they're the supporters and consumers of news and they're empowered more, it does have to change the way that journalists think when they deliver news. And how are they going to be different? And that's the big thing, Rob. It's how am I going to be different to the other journalists? And that's going to be a real challenge for those who emerge.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that's very true of sort of some of the things we've touched on. You know, there's players who use their social media differently, like a Marcus Rashford, for example, to raise awareness of certain causes. There are fan channels who do phenomenal work for their clubs and their local areas, their communities. They give voices to all kinds of different people. And it was probably the same 30 years ago. What is your voice? What is your distinctive voice that you're bringing to your writing, to your club, to your league, to your sport, to your racing team, or whatever it is? Distinctive voices will always be heard. And social media is maybe giving rise to distinctive voices that maybe are saying the wrong things sometimes and maybe going to the extreme. So I'm with you a little bit, Chris. I think there's going to certainly be a shift towards more of that sort of media personality of journalism, which was probably always there, but not as public as it was. You know, you'd always read a certain column on a Monday and an ex-player would have their column on a Thursday. And that was kind of how you read your paper over the week, wasn't it? Whereas now I think that's how people are curating their social media. I suppose the thing I always think with social media is you should have as many voices that disagree with you that agree with you. Because actually, if you only follow people that follow all the same points as you, you don't actually get a very well-rounded...
It becomes propaganda, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's propaganda, yeah.
And I don't mean by sort of people who are offensive or, you know, have got really extreme views. I just mean follow people from your club who don't think the same as you, who maybe think you should be playing a different left-back or a different manager should be in the dugout or you should attack more down the right than the left or whatever it is. Find those people. I think that's the thing I always think. Find those people who maybe are a little bit different. And that's where, like a Fabrizio Romano, it's just like watching Sky Sports News, but on Twitter. You know, it's not really, I'm not really feeling anything about the players. I just know that they've got a five-year contract. It's 50 million quid plus 10 million add-ons. Great, perfect.
I think, you know, what has been good is seeing clubs react a little bit. Certainly, the relationship with social media used to be quite stuffy. And clubs were a little bit unwilling to maybe engage and interact with fans. That's changing now. We're seeing more and more, you know, we're speaking on the Monday after the Watford-Luton derby, and Watford put this video out about what Luton, going around and visiting the Luton, the sites of Luton, and it was pretty condescending and it was meant as a bit of fun and let's face it, it backfired because they lost. But That's the kind of level that a lot of supporters want to see. They want to see that kind of, dare I use the word, banter and fun. And clubs are wising up to that in the way they deliver news of signings or the way they engage with fans after a good result. And it is always after a good result because after a bad result, everyone hates their club and they tell their social media person who's on about 20 grand to tell the manager that he's picking the wrong players or sack the manager. The next tweet we want to see is of a corner flag, you know, and not realizing that the poor kid who's posting these things is just come out of university and he's having to deal with all of the abuse. And so it remains a fun but a toxic relationship at times.
Yeah, certainly. I think now that we've sort of come into extra time on our podcast, that's a perfect spot to leave it. I think, Chris, it's got that element of fun, especially if you're a Burnley fan and you get all those crazy transfer announcements in sort of June, July and August. I think they're absolutely perfect. But there's that underlying toxicity that that has really changed how we digest football and media and generally kind of probably interact with one another as well. We said before the podcast started that we don't always get answers to these questions, but we can kind of discuss some of the issues and that around them. So Chris, that's been a really enjoyable conversation. I think there's probably other threads that we can pick up maybe in other episodes, maybe around sort of players' mental health, fans' mental health, managers' mental health that comes out of some of this toxicity that we see on social media. But from me and Chris today, we'll leave it there. So thank you, Chris, for being part of the pod today. And fans out there, if you've got kind of any funny social media stories, would be quite nice to hear at the end of the pod, or you've got your own podcast or your own output that you put out there, do share it with us and highlight it for us and let us have a little look. And we will be back next time on The Game with another issue from Modern Football. Thanks, everyone.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.